Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We're very excited about today's show with filmmaker Kevin Miller. We had phenomenal feedback from the last time Kevin visited our show and discussed his last film, which was called Hellbound. He does really high-caliber documentaries, Michael Moore-level caliber, and explores a lot of things related to those of us interested in spiritual questions and big issues. And he's going to be back with us in a minute discussing his new film, JES USA. And so if you can visualize the name, it's Jesus with an ah at the end, like the Pentecostal preachers would say when the Holy Ghost hit them. They say, Jesus ah, is here. Ah. So it's JES USA, Jesus with an A. And the website for the film is JESUSAfilm.com, and JESUSAfilm also is the tag for Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, where you can find all of that. This film's of particular interest to me. Many of you that have listened to the show for a while know my wife Sherry and I met and married at Liberty University way back in 1984. Can you imagine, nearly 36 years ago? And our school was pretty much steeped in the mindset that Kevin Miller's film addresses, which is the merging of Christianity, Jesus, with a kind of militant, I don't think he would say Republican, but at least in my background, it was a very extreme right-wing mindset, and that Jesus was kind of merged with all this. And so what are the consequences theologically? I mean, how does it affect the gospel? How does it affect the church when those things are merged? And the brilliant thing about Kevin's film as we explore today with Kevin is it gets into even the historical roots of this, going back to Constantine. And, you know, those of you that are church history buffs, the early church was known for love. The Romans said, behold how they love one another. And then Constantine said he saw the cross, and in the sign of the cross conquer, which, fortunate for the Christians, ended their persecution, but unfortunately seemed to lose quite a bit of the potency and power. There were, of course, benefits, and they put the Bible together and the creeds together and different things like that. So Kevin, when he goes into a subject, he really goes into it. It's not a superficial treatment. So I want you all to share this link with your friends now and tune in, and we're going to discuss this powerful, provocative film, JES USA. In 20 seconds, we'll be back with Kevin. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. Bob Dylan had a song years ago with God on our side, talking about all the people waging wars and saying God was on their side. Well, this is a film you got to see this year, and I want to welcome to the broadcast filmmaker Kevin Miller, director of JES USA. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, Richard. Good to be here.
Well, we're honored to have you here again. I know you're not a person who makes a film on assignment. You're a person who makes a film because you have, you know, in your heart a passion, a burning desire to explore something. How did this become, the next film for you? What led you to this subject?
Well, I actually worked on some other things after Hellbound, but this, I really wanted to do a sequel to Hellbound because I think Hellbound, it's a film that looks at why is universalism, the idea that all people will be ultimately reconciled to God and each other, why is that such a controversial idea? Why do people find that so offensive? In fact, they find it more offensive than the idea that the majority of humanity might suffer for eternity in hell. So what's going on there? And underlying that whole question is the question of violence, and really, what is the nature of God? Is God's final word to evil a violent word? You know, we're told in the Bible, you know, don't try and overcome evil with evil, overcome evil with good. But is that what God ultimately does? Is the final word a violent word from God that sequesters, that possibly torments people for all eternity? It's a very unsatisfying answer. to what is the ultimate nature of the universe. And so I do touch on the question of violence and nationalism in Hellbound, but I really wanted to do a follow-up to the film that makes those issues front and center. And so I just, had the opportunity. I was approached by some folks who had some funding, and they were also interested in exploring this idea. So I was set loose to embark on this topic. And, I called the film JES USA. I should say that the original working title of the film was called The Silence of the Lamb. And I thought it was kind of a clever idea, because the question is, why is the Lamb of God, the peace, the peace-loving, peace-making side of God, why has that Lamb been silent throughout much of the church history, church's history? But I kind of joke that when I pitched that title to Greg Boyd, who's in the film, he immediately launched into an impersonation of Hannibal Lecter, and I said, okay, I never want to see that either. And so I thought, we need to change this title. But it kind of occurred to me, the title kind of crept up on me, because what I was finding is, as I was going around doing interviews with all kinds of folks and asking questions about this issue of violence and really how do we live as people of peace in the midst of the biggest military superpower the world has ever seen, the problem that kept coming up in interview after interview, the problem that was identified, was this issue of nationalism, and particularly a militaristic nationalism, where somehow the Christian faith and America have been fused into one idea, hence the title, JES USA, where Jesus flows into the acronym or the abbreviation for the United States of America. And so it's impossible, really, to separate the two. And so that's what this film ends up really exploring.
Wow. And by the way, you guys can call in. I know this is going to be something you want to ask questions, or email questions to richardrossilive@gmail.com. And the guest call-in number's on the screen, 347-637-2379, or send an email to richardrossilive@gmail.com. I got this email, it's kind of, we can chuckle at it, but it's Anthony Hopkins. This is from Karen Covell here in Hollywood, has a kind of prayer ministry. She prays for different actors, and says, Anthony Hopkins just gave an interview on two popes, saying that he's come to believe in a power greater than himself. I have to believe there's something bigger than me, I am compelled to say. This is Anthony Hopkins' quote she sent. There's somebody bigger than me running this show, and I just want to thank him and say thank you very much. So Hannibal Lecter, maybe he's getting on track. But, I think the title you have is very clever, because there is that merging of the two. And it's so hard to, for those of us raised in it, my background, as I mentioned, at Liberty University, a real mixture of militarism and nationalism and politics. And you even have a clip from Jerry Falwell Jr. in the film where he tells the students about carrying guns to shoot the Muslims. And, one issue that arises with fundamentalists when I've challenged that is because I was one that started to raise questions even when I went to the school there. So I went from somebody that spoke in the services to persona non grata for a while because they started asking too many questions about it. But one of the questions, when you bring up that uncomfortable merging of the violence and Christianity, is they go to the Old Testament scriptures where, and the Lord told them to slaughter the next town and take the virgin daughters from themselves and that kind of a thing. And they seem to just insert America in those stories that we have this divine imprimatur to, whatever military action we take,
Right. Well, and I think that's what you would call a flat Bible approach. Like we, as a Christian, Jesus is the ultimate revelation of God. And so that the Bible, including the Old Testament, needs to be read through the gospel of Christ. And Jesus himself and Paul in particular, they were constantly reinterpreting the Old Testament and editing it. And what they were doing was always removing the violence. Even when Jesus introduces himself in Luke, he quotes Isaiah. And in the passage that he quotes in Isaiah, he actually removes he stops the quotation right before it starts to speak about God's vengeance. So what Jesus is doing is bringing a reset to the minds of his contemporaries to because they've taken religion and turned it into a weapon. And what Jesus is doing is disarming, as my friend Derek Flood, who's in the film, he has a book called Disarming the Gospel, And that's really what Jesus is doing, is disarming religion and trying to reset our view of God. And Paul is doing a very similar thing. So to go to the Old Testament and to try and use some things that are being said there and kind of do a one-to-one comparison to our present-day situation, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, something Greg Boyd talks about is, you know, there's two kingdoms. It's not just him. There's other people as well. This idea that there's the kingdom of this world, and the power of that kingdom is the sword. So how is the world ordered? It's ordered through violence. Like Brian Zahn says in the film, the lines on the map tell a bloody tale. And that and Heraclitus, ancient Greek philosopher, you know, violence is the ordering of the world. But then you have the kingdom of God, and the foundational principle of that kingdom is the cross. And what the cross represents is self-sacrifice on behalf of my neighbor, and in the ultimate form, on behalf of my enemies. And so the two are mutually incompatible. Like, I kind of joked with Greg when I interviewed him, well, can't you hold the sword in one hand and the cross in the other? And he's like, that's exactly the problem. He says, but you can't, because the minute you lay down the cross, you pick up the sword. You can't hold them both because they're fundamentally incompatible. How do you love your enemy self-sacrificially while you're slaughtering them? You just simply can't do it. Now, some people might say, well, okay, I'm only killing my enemy to protect innocence, so I'm actually acting in a self-sacrificial way toward some group that can't protect themselves. But the gospel doesn't allow us that room. The gospel doesn't distinguish between those close to me and those far away. The way a friend of mine puts it is, you know, the test of whether or not we love God is whether or not we love our neighbor. And the test of whether or not we love our neighbor is whether we love our enemy. So we really only love God as much as we love the person we hate the most. And
wow.
That's a pretty exacting test, and it should cause us to do a heart check. And what I hope this film does, like this film, underlying the film is René Girard's mimetic theory, which you know, René Girard was a French philosopher who argued that, you know, the fundamental truth about human beings is that we imitate each other, and our tendency to imitate each other leads us to compete against each other and leads us to violence. And so the way we deal with that problem is we tend to scapegoat somebody, and we channel all our violence onto that individual, as opposed to, you know, descending into some kind of war of all against all. But we're masters at projecting evil. We're masters at projecting evil onto somebody else instead of looking at the evil within our hearts. And so what I hope this film will do will be to prompt that kind of introspection, that whenever we're confronted by somebody that we're told we should hate, or, you know, who's kind of framed as an enemy, you know, to really look at that person as a mirror of something that's going on in our own hearts. Because that's ultimately what Jesus is constantly directing people to, is stop externalizing evil, look to your own self, look at what's going on inside, deal with the evil within, and then, you know, that will manifest itself in the world.
Mm. Well, that's powerful, Kevin. You know, the old axiom Jesus said about don't try to get the beam out of their eye, don't get the speck out of their eye, get the beam out of your own. How can people see the film? Will it be in theaters, streaming, DVDs, all the above?
We're not going to do theatrical release on this film. What we, you know, my experience on Hellbound was that when you're trying to challenge people on a minority theological position, it's very difficult to aggregate your audience into theaters. And where people want to consume this content is at home. They want to consume it in a small group setting or something like that. So we are doing a number of what we call community screenings around the country. We just had one last night in Chicago. I'm about to fly off to North Carolina to do one in Asheville. We've had in
LA. I saw
that
with Jesus People in Chicago.
It was at Loyola University.
Oh, great. And where's the one in Asheville coming up? We have some listeners down there.
Yeah, it's actually in Asheville, North Carolina, not Nashville, Tennessee. That's going to be...
Is that at the Wild Goose Festival?
No, but it's Gareth Higgins who founded the Wild Goose Festival. He's got a festival called Movies and Meaning, and so we'll be screening there this weekend on Saturday. It's February 22nd. So we're doing community screenings across the United States. And then when we actually release the film, which will be happening March 24th, it'll be available on Apple TV, formerly iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, initially a pay-per-view type thing where you can rent it or purchase it, and then sometime later in the year it will be on a streaming platform as well.
Wow, that's fantastic. One of the issues that your film struck me too was you brought up early on in the film was the issue of, you know, even police brutality and violence within America itself. And that's been an odd issue for me with my evangelical friends in that from the white suburbs where I come from, I've had friends literally get emotionally, you know, upset and angry at even bringing up the issue that police sometimes are trigger happy or because they're like, you know, they're laying down our lives. You shouldn't criticize them at all. They're always right, that sort of a thing. And I do have friends that are police, and I salute them. But I wrote a song about the death of Michael Brown called The Death of Michael Brown that kind of went viral. And it was just a quick thing I did, Kevin, to vent my feelings about trigger-happy cops. And the lyrics went something like, down at the courthouse on a Monday afternoon, justice was thrown out the window when a young white cop entered the room, and it told the story. I got threats, death threats from like religious right militias and white supremacists and KKK type groups, and I was shocked. I mean, I was so startled. I knew that some people would not like the song, but just the level of you can't even question, you know, this issue of those we've deemed appropriate to have the guns and keep us in check, and you know. If you're an African-American person, you totally know it. Like my black preacher friends, my black gospel friends, they've been pulled over many times, you know, driving home from preaching a sermon at their church, which your film shows a pastor talking about that. But I wonder if, not to scare you or anything, but I imagine like white evangelicals are going to, it seems like that's a sacred cow you can't touch with some of them.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm safely ensconced up here in Canada, so. But, yeah, you know, I agree with you. I mean, I would, again, I have friends who are police officers as well, and, you know, I would say that almost every person who enters the police force or the military, for that matter, they're doing it for good reasons. Like, they're doing it for heroic reasons, for noble reasons, because they feel a call to, you know, be a shepherd. Like we have these guys in the film who make a distinction between sheep, sheepdogs, and wolves. And so, you know, they have this kind of sheepdog mentality that they want to protect the flock. And, you know, that along with that will go using the threat of force. And so I would never want to disparage anybody who does that. But at the same time, we all know that a culture can develop. A dysfunctional culture can develop amongst some police forces or some areas of the police force. You may be familiar with the term the blue wall, that there's a tendency to pull together and to protect our own. And so what ends up happening is a shift away from the original reason why somebody got into the force to a perpetuation of really protecting each other. And that's a natural psychological shift. You know, they say soldiers, ultimately, when they're in the heat of battle, it's about protecting the person beside them. You know, there's a very strong sense of brotherhood and sisterhood. And so I think it's up to every police officer to try and resist that and to try and remember that, you know, the whole goal of being in that position and wielding so much power is to be a force of good in the world. And I recognize that there's a lot of pressures that are put on individual officers by the power structure that can potentially corrupt some of those initial idealistic impulses that people have when they join the force.
Mm. Wow, very well said. We're having some messages, questions coming in as well, Kevin. So we'll be right back with you, Kevin, and see what's coming in here. It's stirring up some conversation. So I will be right back. Just hang in there, Kevin, for a few seconds.
All right.
Spanish American war had its day, and the Civil War too was soon laid away, and the names of the heroes I was made to memorize God on their side.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. This question coming in here from Irene, she said her husband is a cop and he feels he's acting Christ-like or loving by protecting people. What is the balance? Can we find a balance between violence or militaristic Christianity and complete pacifism, she's asking. By the way, Kevin, I don't know if you saw, but on Valentine's Day, my wife and I stopped and picked up the LA Times, and they had an article, Kevin, on the front page about these different groups who are like these new ministries emerging, and their quote-unquote ministry is to go into all these churches and train them how to shoot people in the service that come in shooting them. And they do all these drills in the church with the kids and everything. And what if they come in the Sunday school room? And then they give them pellet guns and things like that. And this is on front page of LA Times, Valentine's Day. This is becoming a big thing, as you know, the shootings. I guess we could address Irene's question on the balance. But I have another question, too. Maybe I'll try to hold it. I'm so anxious to ask you another question regarding that article.
Sure.
But, I guess we'll start with Irene, since it came in. What do you think about that? I mean, is there a balance for cops and Army having their place? I mean, not to make you pontificate, because I know you let a lot of the speakers speak for yourself. And if I could compliment you real quickly, I do want to tell you, Kevin, I thought you did an excellent job showing both sides. You had the guys that would run those sort of groups in the beginning of the film. You let them say their piece and their view. You didn't caricature them. I don't think anyone, I mean, certainly you have a point of view, but I don't think anyone can accuse you of not giving them their voice in the beginning of the film. But what's your thought about the balance, Kevin? And I thought you did an excellent job letting them speak up in the first half of the film.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, we actually have some guys who do that type of training for churches and other organizations to help them prepare for a mass shooter situation or other kinds of violence brought against them. To address Irene's question, Jimmy Meeks, who's a guy we feature in the film, he was a cop for 40 years in Dallas, which is, you know, not an easy place to be a police officer. And he did not draw his gun once throughout those 40 years. He was also a hostage negotiator.
Yeah,
and
all those
cops I liked
growing up on TV as a little boy. I'm going to date myself, Kevin. I'm a Scooby-Doo baby boomer, so I might be a little older than you. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. But all the cops I loved on TV, like Columbo and McMillan, they would never have a gun, you know?
Right. Yeah, well, because they use their brains, you know. And this is the problem with violence is that I'm not sure if you're familiar with Frank Herbert's Dune series, science fiction series.
Oh, yeah, is that the one
David
Lynch made into a film?
Yeah, that's right, and it's being remade into a film now by Denis Villeneuve as well. And there's a litany against fear that this group of priestesses say in the book, and they talk about how fear is the mind killer. And fear is the thing that leads us to be violent. And the minute we give in to fear, we really have two options. We have fight or flight. And so the thing about violence and especially resorting to deadly force is that it tends to prevent us from seeking other creative solutions to a crisis. And what I would say that, you know, somebody who is a police officer has been authorized by the state to use deadly force, but I would hope that every officer on the force would think that that is the last thing that they want to do, is to use deadly force. And I think one of the problems with the police, and even if you think about crossing a border these days, I always kind of chuckle at the people at the border because they're basically glorified paper pushers, but they're wearing body armor and sidearms. And the police around the world have been so heavily militarized, and there's an indoctrination so that, you're starting to feel like a soldier. You're starting to feel like that's what you're there for. There's a great fear as well, especially in America. You pull somebody over on the side of the highway, you have no idea what kind of armament you're looking at inside that vehicle. So I guess I would say in terms of a balance, I mean, my sense is that any person of faith who is on the police force, they've automatically put themselves in a conflicted position because from a career point of view, they are answerable to the state. And if the state says they must use violence, they must use violence. The same thing is true of a soldier. But if you are also a citizen of the kingdom of God, that is a higher calling on your life. And that higher calling is to love your enemies as yourself. Now, sometimes, though, I think that you can, I don't know how I would put it, like put it this way, locking your doors at night and installing a security system on your home, for instance, is, some people could say that is a form of violence because you're, you know, using force in a sense to secure yourself against possible invaders. But I actually think that can almost be a blessing against somebody who might attempt violence because it discourages them from doing so. Now, some people might say the threat of violence does the same. The threat of deadly violence on the behalf of a police officer actually is a form of loving one's enemies because it discourages them from taking up arms because they know that it's going to result in their own destruction. But I think history tells us the opposite, that like Martin Luther King says, you know, violence is both immoral and impractical, and it offers no ultimate solution to a problem. And violence is actually most dangerous when it's most successful because it then becomes a model for other people. And so the more militarized the police get, all that does is create an arms race amongst the criminals as well. And we see this militarily too. So I would just hope that, you know, if somebody's a believer who's on the police force, they've been authorized to use deadly force, but my hope for them is that they would exercise the creativity that opens, you know, that the gospel gives them to pursue other options. And this is another thing too, you know, this is where religion becomes very practical. If you believe this life is all that there is, the only thing that makes sense is self-preservation at all costs. But if you believe that there is a world beyond this one, that if you die, you will be resurrected at some point in the future, if you believe in God and that there's, you know, that there's a bigger life than this, you can actually risk self-sacrifice on behalf of another. And so, again, that opens up opportunities and new ways of dealing with conflict situations that aren't available if you're functioning purely in a self-preservation mode, because then you're just stuck with fight or flight.
Wow. I have to share with you, Kevin, I think you really appreciate this. And by the way, the film, you guys got to see this film. I absolutely love it, and endorse it as a very powerful film that's you all need to watch and think about. And it's you can go to the website jesusafilm.com or jesusafilm at Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Kevin, recently my son and I took the subway, the red line here in Los Angeles, down to an LA Clippers basketball game. And we were returning on the subway, and forgive me if I might have told you this before, but we're on the subway coming back, and there's a guy maybe in his 60s, although it's hard to tell because people on the streets, you know, sometimes look older, salt and pepper beard, rambling obscenities, a homeless guy, and seems out of his mind. He's about six rows from us. The subway stops at Hollywood and Highland. A young black man, about 30 years old, gets on with his date and sits down in the seat that was available near the homeless guy. And the homeless guy starts screaming at him, and I won't swear for FCC rules on the broadcast, but say enough of it that you get the feel of it. He starts screaming over and over like a mantra at the black guy, effing N-word, effing N-word, effing N-word, effing N-word. You know, more and more loud. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, Lord, this, you know, may be a confrontation here. Black guy stands up, looks down at him at a first, and then he looks from, like, his look of offense shifts, and a loving look comes on the guy's face, and he says, I got some money to help you get something to eat, and I got some food here. And he gives him, like, some non-perishable food, like a box of raisins and some other things. Then he takes out a wad of cash, Kevin, gives the man some cash, and he says, be at peace. And this homeless man quiets down. It's almost like the gospel stories where the demons leave the guy, you know, and he has this peaceful look on his face. The homeless guy, the rest of the ride home is peaceful. The black guy sits down by his girlfriend, discusses the play they saw. And my son and I were just astounded, Kevin. I said to my son, Josh, that was one of the most Christ-like things, tangible examples of Jesus Christ I have ever seen. And my son agreed. And I thought about your film. I watched your film either right after that or right before it. And I was like, this is what Kevin's film is about. Because in the Sermon on the Mount, I'll be honest, it's hard for me to follow his teachings, you know, turning the other cheek. But this black man truly turned the other cheek. He turned away from that violent, hateful energy, and he turned the other cheek in the sense of giving the complete opposite energy of love in the face of the hate. And I'll never forget it as long as I live, Kevin.
Yeah, well, and I think it's such a great illustration of, you know, what we talk about in the film, too, is that our tendency is when something like that is brought against us is to mirror it. We'll imitate it, but try and top it as well. And so if violence is brought against us, we'll bring violence in return, but we'll try and deliver that blow that will be so powerful that it will bring an end to the escalation. But what tends to happen is just pure escalation. I mean, I think pop culture tells us this all the time. I think Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, that's exactly what it's about. If you watch the movie The Dark Knight, the Joker is constantly lecturing Batman on the fact that his presence in Gotham has given rise to an entirely new breed of criminal. And it's because he's kind of forced the issue by bringing such tremendous violence against the criminals in Gotham. They're forced to respond in kind. And so they look to now Batman as a model. Oh, this is how you impose your will on the city. Great, we're going to do it, but we're going to do it in a way that you don't have the guts to do because you're bound by some kind of moral principle that we don't hold to. And so violence, it can be done. We always look at our violence as good. Our violence is always done for the right reason. Our violence is only done out of a sense of wanting to protect the flock. It's only done as a form of prevention. It's only done to perpetuate some kind of a good ideal. We can always come up with a reason to justify our violence and always make it look good. And then we paint the enemy's violence as if it's bad. But it's a seductive thing because, you know, wanting to protect the flock can very quickly lead us to start looking suspiciously at people and going, you know what, I don't like the way they look. I don't know what they're talking about over there, but I think we better go get them before they get us. And next thing you know, in the name of freedom, quote unquote, and justice and truth and all these sorts of things, we become the biggest perpetuator of death and violence in the world. And unfortunately, I think that's the situation the United States finds itself in right now. You know, I think a lot of Americans see themselves as, you know, these peaceful, loving people. But, it's talk to black people within the country. I was just watching a documentary on NWA, the rap group. I mean, and, you know, it was kind of looking at their music as a form of protest music in the 1990s of what was going on at the hands of the LAPD back then, if you were a black person. But look at people all over the world where America has, removed democratically elected leaders. They've destabilized so many countries around the world. I mean, Americans have a perception of themselves as these peaceful people, but really the country is a hugely destabilizing force around the world. And I think as Christians, you can't expect nations to adhere to the gospel, but we can expect Christians within those nations to be agents of peace rather than enablers and cheerleaders of war. And unfortunately, the situation we're seeing is more and more, particularly white evangelicals, are some of the first people to, start cheering for some of these foreign adventures that America has gotten itself involved in. And it's a tragic thing to see. And we try really hard in this film to be bipartisan. This isn't necessarily about the right or the left. I mean, I think the left in some ways is more violent, at least in terms of, a verbal form of violence than the right is. But it's a problem on both sides of the floor. And the biggest problem is we can't see it because we're so caught up in pointing our finger at some enemy that we never you know, whenever we walk by a mirror, we never look in it. I think partly because we're afraid of what we're going to see. But that's really my greatest hope, that what this film would do is to get us to stop pointing the finger of violence at other people, or stop pointing the finger of blame at other people, and go, what am I doing in this world? What am I, am I contributing to the destabilization of the world, or am I acting like that black guy in the subway? And instead of returning evil for evil, I respond with good. Because what happens is it completely disrupts the cycle. The arms race stops at that moment because, first of all, the other person's confused because you're not playing to the script. And it forces them now to think differently. And also, like, I think one of the great things when Jesus says, you know, if somebody, you know, hits you on the cheek, turn and offer the other cheek as well, you know, that's a very strategic move, you know, in that culture, that the right hand was used for eating and the left hand was used for other things. And so by turning your other cheek, you're forcing the person to use their left hand, and to it's a huge disrespect to the person they're striking, but it's also a shameful thing to do for the person who's doing the striking. So it instantly puts them in a state where they have to examine themselves, and they're brought to an awareness of their own violence. And that's what Jesus is constantly trying to do. He's not trying to condemn people for being violent. He's trying to awaken them to the price that is being paid for their so-called holiness, which is often enforced by violence.
So the striking with one of the hands was looked at as a shameful thing to, for the person doing the striking.
Well, because you're going to use your unclean hand to touch another person.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not something you would normally do. And so you're going to stop and think for a moment. You know, so there's that moment of self-awareness. And I think, again, this is what the problem is that we're not self-aware. We are full of a myth. We're under the delusion of this view of ourselves, which is not in touch with reality at all. And we think of ourselves as these good, peaceful people, when in fact, you know, we're the beneficiaries of a huge amount of violence. And we're either passively ignoring it, or enabling it somehow, or we're actively encouraging it. But somehow or other, you know, especially people like us who are living in, you know, the developed, you know, the haves part of the world. I think we just have to really think about who's paying the price for this existence that we have, and what can we do to try and mitigate some of that.
Mm. You mentioned NWA, the rap group, and I remember when I first heard some of their songs criticizing the cops. As a working as a minister at the time in a 99.9% white church, I was just so appalled that they would criticize the cops in those songs. And that was on the East Coast. And now I live in Los Angeles. I've gotten to know a lot of the black guys and the hip-hop guys that are my friends. And when they talk about the impetus of some of that work, how, you know, they were recording in Compton or wherever their studio was, and just taking a break from recording, and a bunch of cops making them get on the ground and sticking guns to their head, and they, you know, not even doing anything, just taking a break, a smoke break or whatever, recording the song. And so, you know, understanding these other cultures. You mentioned, too, that the evangelicals are some of the quickest to cheer on the violence. I witnessed that firsthand also, Kevin. And it's quite odd, but in the fundamentalist background I come from, as you're well familiar with, there's an interpretation of the book of Revelation that the Antichrist is about to emerge from our world leaders. And so a lot of these people, when Obama was president, they were all freaking out. Obama's the Antichrist, and he's going to declare martial law, and we got to stockpile our weapons, to, you know, et cetera. So they have this very doom and gloom eschatology. And some of these very same people, when I've been sitting around with them watching the news coming on the TV, and they talk about war or a bomb in the Middle East or someone shooting in the Middle East, I've seen these very same people get happy and gleeful, like, yes, prophecy's being fulfilled, the rapture's coming, this is the sign. And they almost cheer on the violence from an eschatology standpoint, too, that this shows we're going to get raptured out of here. It's the beginning of Armageddon. And so due to this interpretation of the Bible, they think it's a waste of time to even negotiate for peace, because they will say things like, why is the president wasting his time trying to negotiate peace with Palestine and Israel? Because the Bible clearly says there will be no peace till the Prince of Peace returns and blah, 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 blah. So their theology, you know, causes them to not even have any openness to, you know, peace in the world. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre and troubling. I mean, it exhibits a very cult-like behavior in that, you know, it's so far, to me, in my mind anyway, it just seems so far removed from what my understanding of the gospel would be, which, you know, what is Jesus, you know, boiling it down to, you know, he's calling us to love God, excuse me, to love God with all our mind, heart, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. I mean, it's a de-escalation of conflict. So to sit here and gleefully look at war and rumors of war, some fulfillment of some kind of a prophecy, especially because it's a prophecy of divine violence, ultimately, it just seems so far removed from the gospel. But this kind of gets into, well, that's just my way of interpreting the Bible. And so who's to say that my way of looking at that is correct? And, I mean, that's a tough question to answer because we all, you know, respond to whatever sort of faith tradition that we were raised in, and we consider that to be authoritative. But I would just hope that no matter what tradition we hold to, that we would, number one, remember that we're always reading the Bible through some sort of interpretive lens. This is the first thing that, the first and most important thing that some people, I'll engage with people all the time, that they actually deny that they're even doing that. They're saying, I don't interpret, I just read the Bible the way it is. Well, number one, if you're reading it in English, that's impossible because the English text is an interpretation that you're now interpreting through some kind of a faith tradition. And that's going to be informed by also by your experience. It's going to be informed by whatever arguments you've inherited. So I just hope that no matter what tradition we hold to, that we'd be willing to question it. And we will recognize it is but one of many traditions. And the only reason why we're privileging it in our minds is because we, for some reason or another, have arrived at a conclusion that it is authoritative. Other people disagree with us, so I think it's important all the time to pay attention to why. What are they seeing that we're not? Or what are we missing that they're seeing? And that, you know, applies to this question of violence. It applies to these questions of end times theories and that sort of thing. But I think that, again, one of the key litmus tests we have to come back to is, does this theology make me more loving toward my neighbor and more loving toward my enemy? Or does it do the opposite? Does it kind of make me feel like I'm part of this exclusive club and I almost become gleeful when I hear of something, you know, terrible happening in another part of the world? That's not, you know, that's failing the litmus test right there. You know, if you're more concerned that your theology is proven right in the end than you are of just want, you know, if you're more concerned about that than you are about being a force of goodness in your community, I think that's a key indicator that your theology is off base and that you should reexamine it.
Wow, excellent. And by the way, RichardRossiLive@gmail.com, you can send in your questions here. We have a bunch coming in, or call the number on your screen. We'll be right back with you, Kevin. I'm going to check some of these questions here coming in. We'll be back in a few seconds with Kevin again.
The First World War, boys, it came and it went. The reason for fighting, but I learned to accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and we have some questions from folks saying they're on the left, the right, and everywhere in between. From the right side of the aisle, let's see here. Anthony in Scottsdale, Arizona says, what about the bad people, ISIS, Osama bin Laden, Hitler? Don't we have to use force to stop them? If not, why don't they take over the world and oppress the world?
Well, again, this gets back to what is the role of Christians you know, Christians were, if you think about the earliest Christians, they were living in an occupied territory. It was occupied. They weren't worried about the threat of ISIS coming and taking over. ISIS had taken over in the form of the Roman Empire. And it was a very antagonistic invasion of their country. And so, of course, that's why so many of Jesus' followers wanted him to rise up and form a violent movement to repel these invaders. But every time he was given that invitation or kind of, maybe shamed into trying to take that on, he always refused and always told people to put down their swords. And his the first generation and several generations of Christians functioned in exactly the same way, that they didn't look at this global superpower as something that they needed to rise up and overcome, that instead what they did was they stood as a nonviolent witness in the face of the state violence brought against them, and eventually they brought the empire around to their way of looking at things, to the point that Christianity was legitimized. Now, there were some prices to be paid for that, but we're not called to overcome evil with evil, and what we are called to do is to pick up our cross and follow Jesus. And we may die. In fact, very likely, if we go and try and do that in the face of ISIS, we will die. So, you know, as we say in the film, nonviolence is a short-term self-preservation plan. Terrible idea. But if we take a longer view and look at what might be accomplished if millions of Christians faithfully witness to what the life they've been called to live, that power will eventually transform the hearts of those who are persecuting people who are innocent. So what a Christian is called to do is to love their enemies, to do good to those who hurt them, to never return evil for good. What the outcome of that is out of our hands. But we know without a doubt that that is what we have been called to do. And some people might say, well, what, are you willing to sacrifice people's lives, you know, just so you can, you know, stick to this ideal? It doesn't matter if you... whether you pursue violence or nonviolence, you are going to sacrifice other people's lives in pursuit of your ideal. If you use violence, innocent people are going to die. If you pursue nonviolence, innocent people are going to die, possibly even you. But nonviolence is the way of ultimately not only overcoming your enemy, but actually transforming your enemy. And the multiplying effect of it can be just phenomenal. So that would be my response to that.
Kevin, I'm realizing, too, I want to respect your time. We reached the, I think we said we go about 45 minutes. We've reached that time, and this is such an interesting subject. I just want to see, are you okay to go a bit longer,
sure,
maybe to the half hour, another, I guess it'll be about 12 minutes or so. Are you still good?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, another question, and this kind of pulls at the heart because it deals with a child. This is a woman, Dawn, in North Carolina, Charlotte. It's a pretty long, and I'll just get to the heart of it. Basically, she has a son, she says, that's a couple years maybe developmentally behind, a very sensitive, and the tougher boys in school, you know, punch him, you know, bully him. The husband said he needs to, you know, stand up to them, punch him in the nose, basically stop the bully, confront the bully, and the mother is trying to get him to not go the violent route. Wanted to know, Richard and Kevin, what about a child in that situation and Christ's teachings? You know, I tell you, I do have a little experience with this growing up. I grew up in a tough neighborhood with bullies, and I did stand up for a kid like this kid in school who was lived across the street from me, and I played with him, and he was, you know, not good at sports, and they called him a sissy and that sort of thing. And the bullies would just literally walk up to him on the bus and sock him in the nose, and I stood up to him, and then they wanted to fight me, and then I got in a fist fight with the bully. I got the better of the bully the first time, which got me some respect in the bully and that sort of thing. But it did escalate also, where all of a sudden, because I was stood up to the bullies gang, so to speak, were always wanting to fight me, and so it made school very uncomfortable with me, and it did escalate. And also I ended up having a court thing as a young man for fights with the bullies. And so it's, you know, I mean, I did see the dad's point in that standing up to him, I got him to back off from the kid, but I see Kevin's point, and then it also got me in a lot of hot water that I wish I could go back and find a better way out of it. But
This is a tough one, Kevin. It is, because these little kids, you know, someone's harassing them at school, and, you know, the dad's concerned that the bullies will see that as weakness and just keep harassing the kid. I know we're not child psychologists, or this might not be our fields of expertise, but do you have any thoughts on something like this?
Well, that definitely hits close to me, close home for me as well, because I also experienced a fair amount of bullying in high school, and you know, I'm not a nonviolent person by nature. Like, nothing makes me angrier than that. I have four kids, and one of my sons was experiencing bullying about a year and a half ago, and let me tell you, you want to see my temper go through the roof, it's mm-hmm. that sort of behavior. That starts to make me imagine situations of delicious, violent reprisals because it just triggers something inside of me that I have to deal with. But I can say from experience as well that when I tried to respond to the bullying against myself, or I also stepped in on behalf of friends, whenever I did that, it only ever led to an escalation, and it led to years of misery because it made me then a target. An even worse target of bullying, because they knew that if they pushed me far enough that I would fight. And, you know, I didn't get in trouble with the police, but I got, you know, suspended and just faced, you know, just very strong violence brought against me, both physically and verbally, for years, that I spent a lot of my early adulthood trying to overcome because I internalized a lot of that. And so I understand the dad's impulse, and, you know, there's a thought, and I've been tempted to give my own 15-year-old son that same advice, that, you know what, you need to throw a kid up against the lockers and let him know that, you know, if they keep going, there's going to be a price to be paid. But some people, and that might sound like a great thing, but it's almost always going to backfire on you. I would just encourage, you know, the good thing is that teachers are very aware of the problem of bullying. Unfortunately, it's still rampant. But just the same way we have a legal system so that we don't end up having personal vendettas against people, we have a whole administrative system in schools that is meant to deal with those issues. And I think that instead of putting it on the kid to try and stand up for himself, I think that pressure needs to be applied to the administration to intervene. We had a situation in Canada where a young guy was stabbed to death by some bullies outside of his school in front of his mother, who had actually come to the school to pick him up because he had phoned because he was being bullied. And there had been repeated calls to the administration to deal with this issue, but they failed to do so, and a young man died. So I think that I would really hold the teachers and the principal and the vice principal, hold their feet to the fire, to say, look, this is happening, it's systemic, and it needs to stop.
Yes. We have a question coming in, someone that identifies from the left or Democratic side of the aisle here. By the way, speaking of the left, we brought up the issue of police brutality, and I'm not God. I can't prognosticate, you know, with infallible predictions, but I think this might come up tonight at the Democratic debates here, if any of you are watching. It'll be on, I think, 6 p.m. here, Pacific time in California, I think. I think it's 3 p.m. Eastern time. I could be wrong on that, on NBC and MSNBC. But Bloomberg will probably have questions about his stop and frisk policy, which some felt was police brutality in the sense of racial profile. I mean, just as a digression, but the question from our Democrat friend is, they mentioned the LA Times article I brought up about these kind of religious right militia type training groups, and that they have some that are stockpiling weapons, anticipating the rapture, anticipating the Battle of Armageddon, anticipating government takeover and taking their guns, and they're concerned about their Second Amendment rights, et cetera, and ask, could some of these militia groups become dangerous? She gives a scenario that they are ardent Trump supporters, and could some of these groups, if Trump didn't win the election, say it's fixed and rise up to support Trump? So she has a fear-based kind of scenario that she feels some of these militia groups, Christian militia groups, could become a dangerous force. Any thoughts on that, Kevin?
Yeah, I definitely agree that any militia group, Christian or otherwise, if they feel that they can't get what they want at the polls, that they might decide to resort to violence. I think that that's definitely problematic, but I think it speaks to a broader sense of what's going on in America, in particular, is just a deeper and deeper sense of disenfranchisement, you know, that comes from, you know, huge income disparities. disparities, you know, especially people, white men who are supposed to be part of the haves who find themselves among the have-nots, and that just, and meanwhile, they're kind of being, you know, it's hating on white men in America today is, you know, they're one of the few scapegoats that you can point a finger at with no fear of reprisal.
Yeah.
And yet, if you find yourself within that group and you're not part of the dominant group, you're actually part of the underclass, there's a resentment that's going to grow. And, you know, if you lose faith in the political system, if you lose faith in the economy, and you're trying to provide for your family, you're trying to, you know, form an identity that you can feel secure and proud of, violence can become an appealing opportunity. And or an appealing option for a lot of people. So definitely I think that is a potential. But again, what does that call us to do? I think that as much as possible, I don't have any people like that in my circle. I know one person actually who was stockpiling ammunition under Obama, and I would engage in vigorous debates with that person about what he was doing. But I think that the call, you know, I think the movie Joker was so good in showing how alienated, you know, certain sectors of society are becoming. And I think the call is on us more and more to try and engage these people in constructive dialogue, because they're responding to a real problem, which is all kinds of disparities. It's just that the solutions that they're latching onto are just terribly destructive. And so
I voted on the film awards here, and I voted for Best Actor for Phoenix for Joker, because I thought it did show how a person gets to that state. And all the people I voted for won, with the exception of Best Actress. I'd voted for Harriet, for the actress in Harriet. But, you know, as a final thing, since we're running out of time here, I wanted to tell you, Kevin, that your film has contributed to a deeper understanding of the cross for me. And by the way, those of you listening, jesusafilm.com, you can find out more about this film. But I've been in a shift away from kind of the way I was taught the cross in the fundamentalist days was kind of a good cop, bad cop thing, which you address in your film, where it's like God is so angry at us and hates us and wants to damn us to hell because we're such worthless pieces of crap. And he's just so mad at us. And Jesus is like the good cop coming in and saying, you know what, kill me instead. And but as I meditate on the cross, I think about him, Jesus, saying from the cross, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. The very people killing him. He's just, you know, just unconditional love and mercy and grace and compassion just pouring out as he's forgiving the people killing him. They're not saying a sinner's prayer. They're not going forward, you know, hearing just as I am. I mean, these are the people killing him. And he's just pouring forth. The more I meditate on Jesus and that cross, it's just such a picture of the gold standard of love and forgiveness and returning love in the face of violence. And I think your film just beautifully helps those like myself that want to understand some of these things in a deeper way than maybe the way we were told them, which is we grow and mature doesn't make too much sense.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And, yeah, and I think that, you know, I've really, you know, in the course, because I grew up in a, you know, pretty, at least in my teen years onwards, I grew up in a pretty fundamentalist evangelical way of looking at Christianity. And so the cross represented this sacrifice that was made to God by God in order to pay the penalty for our sin. But what I have come to see the cross as is it's a revelation of the lengths to which God will go to reconcile us to God's self. And that is, God will subject himself to our violence as a way of awakening us to our violence. And that's why I think it's really significant that it's a Roman centurion who on the day of the crucifixion is the first one to recognize that truly this man was the Son of God. This centurion is a representative of the violence that put Jesus up on the cross. And he wakes up to his own violence in the face of that. And so the cross is, as we talk about in the film, this is really, you know, religion. You know, we'll talk about primitive forms of religion, it always involves sacrifice, so that some sacrifice has to be made to the gods in order to appease them. But what the cross, what Jesus does is he brings an end to religion. And what's at the heart of Christianity is not sacrifice to a god, it's self-sacrifice of the god on behalf of the beings that the god has created. And it's not a self-sacrifice to appease himself, it's a self-sacrifice that is meant to bring a revelation of the truth about who we are and how to escape this violent self-centered existence and become a completely new type of being. You know, some people would call Jesus the first true human, and that's then if we emulate him, we become fully human in a way that we can't if we are continually looking out for number one.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for being on the show, and this link will be good in perpetuity. I think it's worth, I know I'm going to share it, and I ask you, those of you listening, to share it with people. It's such an important discussion, and visit the film website, jesusafilm.com. God bless you, Kevin, and thank you for sharing this, making and sharing this powerful film.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss it with you.
God bless you and your family in Canada. British
All right.
Columbia, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, God bless you, Kevin. We'll be watching the film. And thank you, everybody, for listening today. And Abraham Lincoln was asked during the middle of the Civil War, the North said, well, we're praying God's on our side. And General Lee in the South said, we're praying God's on our side as they're shooting each other. And Abraham Lincoln said, it's not so important whether you're praying God be on my side. It's are you on God's side, which is the side of Jesus and love. Love our neighbor, love our enemies, as Bob Dylan talked about in his song With God on Our Side. Thanks for listening to Richard Rossi Live.
The Second World War.